and turn to 2 Chronicles chapter 20. 2 Chronicles chapter 20 and also in verse or chapter 21. We'll be using that as our primary text this morning, or at least our starting point this morning. After this morning's announcements, I may change one of the characters' names to Jason. The preacher had a dilemma on his hands. You see, one of two brothers had died, and he was asked to preside over the funeral, to deliver the eulogy for the older brother, John. And ordinarily, this wouldn't be much of a problem for the preacher. Unfortunately, he had to preside over a number of different funerals. But unlike his younger brother, Ned, who was an elder in the church, he was a respected businessman. He was known far and wide for his kindness and his charity. He was known for being a wonderful, loving father of three children. He was a devoted husband. He cherished his wife and treated her like the princess that she is. But John was just the opposite. You see, the whole town knew that John was an irresponsible, sinful man. He was the town drunk. He used, he abused, and he cheated everyone in town that he had any kind of relationship or relations with. Even his own family disowned him because he had abandoned them years ago. And the preacher knew that this contrast between these two brothers was so well known in town, even the family, that if he tried to just gloss over the reality of John's life, it's going to be perceived at best as hypocrisy, but really it's just an outright lie. So, you know, the preacher decided just to stay with the facts and present the facts of John's life and use this as an opportunity maybe to influence other people. So the preacher started and he said, "Now we all know what kind of man John was, and the sympathy of our family can't change the facts of his life. He cheated many of you in business. He drank or gambled away all the money that should have been used to help his family. He was a selfish, ugly-tempered. He was a terrible..." And about that time, the sheriff was sitting over in the left-hand corner of the auditorium, and he was going, psst, psst, trying to get the preacher's attention. But the preacher was not going to be deterred from the course that he had decided. And he kept on going with what he was saying. And he said that John made no time to serve the Lord. He made no preparations for his death or judgment. And by now the sheriff is just waving his hands, just trying to get the preacher's attention. And the preacher stops and says, "Sir, if you've got something nice to say about John, just go ahead and say it." And the sheriff stood up and says, "Well, no, I don't have anything nice to say about John, but John ain't dead. He's sitting over there with the family. Ned's the one in the coffin." And the preacher just kind of looked at him and couldn't believe that he had made that kind of error, and turned to the family and said, "I apologize for the misunderstanding. But John, you need to realize that this is exactly the sermon I'm going to preach at your funeral when you do die." Now, I wish I could tell you I knew how that story ended. I'd like to believe that John kind of turned his life around, that all of a sudden that impact of hearing his own eulogy, if you will, made enough impact on him that he changed his life. But we do have a similar story, something that reminds me of that very thing found in 2 Chronicles chapter 20. I'm sorry, chapter 21. It's the sad story of the reign of King Jehoram. Now, King Jehoram is the son of King Jehoshaphat. And King Jehoshaphat was a great king. He was doing the things that were right in the sight of God. If you turn back just a couple of pages to chapter 17 about Jehoshaphat's reign, in verse 3, the Lord was with Jehoshaphat because he walked in the earlier ways of his father David, and he did not seek the Baals, but sought the God of his father and walked in his commandments and not according to the practices of Israel. And skip down to verse 6, his heart was courageous in the ways of the Lord. And over we see that Jehoshaphat was in God's favor, and because of that, he was granted peace in his time. If you turn over to chapter 20 in verse 30, so the realm of Jehoshaphat was quiet, for his God gave him rest all around. Now, Jehoshaphat did make some mistakes, however. His reoccurring mistake that seems to have has impacted his legacy, impacted his children, was that he kept company with the wrong kind of people. He made, back in chapter 18, he made an alliance with Ahab and Jezebel, of all people. And he made this alliance, and to his son Jehoram, he married Jezebel's daughter. And he did it again after Ahab was killed in battle at the end of chapter 20. He made another pact with the northern kingdom, another wicked king. And so he constantly didn't learn his lesson, and he made these kinds of bad decisions of the people that he would hang around with and the people that he would form an alliance with. But overall, the kingdom was at peace and prosperous. Jehoshaphat was a prosperous king. And so when he dies, he leaves to his son a very good kingdom, a kingdom that is in actually a very good state. But it doesn't take long for Jehoram to ruin everything. If you pick up in chapter 21, the first thing that we see is that his rule began with selfish cruelty. Look at verse 4 of chapter 21. When Jehoram had ascended to the throne of his father and was established, he killed all his brothers with the sword. That's the very first thing that he does, it seems, is start to kill his brothers and several of the other princes. Why he would do that, no one quite knows. Maybe he felt threatened. We don't know why he did that. But he killed all his brothers. So it begins with selfish cruelty. But it actually gets worse than that. He then goes into personal apostasy. Skip down begin reading in verse 5. Jehoram was 32 years old when he became king, and he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem, and he walked in the way of the kings of Israel as the house of Ahab had done, for the daughter of Ahab was his wife, and he did what was evil in the sight of God. Personal apostasy. So he kills his brothers, he leaves the Lord himself, and he wasn't content with that. He then abuses his royal power. Skip down to verse 11. Moreover, he made high places in the hill country of Judah, and led the inhabitants of Jerusalem into whoredom, and made Judah go astray. Instead of leading them toward righteousness, toward doing the things that God wants, he leads them into whoredom. He leads them into idol worship. Leads them astray. And then all of that ushers in national disaster. Go back to verse 10. So Edom revolted from the rule of Judah to this day. At that time, Libnah also revolted from his rule because he had forsaken the Lord, the God of his fathers. So this land of peace that had existed under his father's reign was now in a national revolt. And his reign ends early and in a miserable death. Go back to the end of that chapter in verse 18. Picking up in verse 18. And after all this, the Lord struck him in his bowels with an incurable disease. In the course of time, at the end of 2 years, his bowels came out because of the disease, and he died in great agony. His people made no fire for his honor, like the fires they had made to his fathers. He was 32 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem, and he departed with no one's regret. And they buried him in the city of David, but not in the tombs of the kings. This is a king of Judah, and no one regretted his death. The word there is, in some translation, says no one desired him. That word desire has to do with something that is lost, something precious that you have lost and you desire to have it back. There is a longing involved in that. No one had those feelings for the king. To no one's regret. What a life that he had. You know, it makes you start to think, what will people say about me when I'm gone? What will they say about you? What is the estimation of us? Now, several of us will say, some people will say, you know, I just don't care what people say about me. You know, and especially, I don't care about what they say about me when I'm gone. And I just don't think that's very true. I think we do care what people say about us. I think we do care what people think about us. Have you ever come up against two people that are talking and you hear your name? What do? You kind of, you want to lean over. You want to know what they're talking about, don't you? Because you're curious. You want to know what people say about you. So please, let's not say we don't care. Because we do care. We care deeply what people think about us, what they say about us. And many people's lives are chronicled in books of history. They leave their mark on us because they were either famous or infamous. They were either heroes or cowards. They were either loyal or traitors. And despite what we might verbally express, I think we do care about what they say about us. And being spiritually minded people, we ought to care. We ought to care about our character. We ought to care about our reputation and how people perceive us. In Proverbs chapter 10, in Proverbs chapter 10 and verse 7, the memory of the righteous is a blessing, but the name of the wicked will rot. The other thing that this man's life says to us is that, you know, no one regretted his passing. I think that says is that he lived a deliberately unprincipled and reprobate life. Because I think there's this universal disposition when someone dies to be lenient in our judgments, to kind of overlook offenses, overlook trespasses, and try to magnify, if we can, any kind of service, any kind of virtue that person might possess. But Jehoram, there was no kindness, there was no service, there was no virtue to magnify. No one regretted, no one desired the fact that he was gone. And I think that just says that this was a life of deplorable failure. You know, if I am only known, when I am gone, and I am only known as a good sales engineer, someone who could bore his children to death when they ask him why there's dew on the ground, you know, then I failed. If Ryan and Nikki are only remembered because they're good at math, that's sad. If Grady, if the only thing we say about Grady when he's gone is, man, he could balance the books, that's a waste, I think. You know, and if Barry, what are you good at? Nothing. But you get the point that I'm trying to make. We want to be remembered in something greater than those things, don't we? In assuming that we want to have a positive influence and leave this world a little better than what we found it, we need to determine what we're going to live like and how we're going to act, both in public and in private. I think it is sad when God has given us these powers. He's given us our very lives so that we can spend them in His honor. And we are to promote real well-being of our fellow man. And we are to enhance ourselves with wisdom and worth to make us fit for higher places. That we should instead degrade this priceless opportunity and waste our powers and waste our very lives by sowing seeds of error, seeds of discord, by not living with holy principles and living selfishly and not doing our best to raise the hearts and minds of men to look toward heaven. I can think of nothing more deplorable than a wasted life. And this kind of life is a painful and pitiful life, to depart and be regretted by no one. No one will mourn for you. No one is going to miss you. To leave and not have any kind of heart that wants to see you or talk to you again. So how do we avoid a fate like that? See, one way or the other, we influence everybody that we come in contact with. We are being watched, we are being followed, we are being imitated. Whether that influence is good or bad is up to you. And you know what people say about you, what people will say about you when you're gone, doesn't happen by accident. We can control that by living the way that we're supposed to live, by not living the way that Jehoram had, like Jacob Marley had told Ebenezer Scrooge, I've forged my chain link by link in life. So how do we do that? How do we leave this world in a better way than we found it? Well, we have to start now. We can't wait. We can't wait a moment. We have to start now living the way God wants us to do. And I think most profoundly we can impact, we can influence the lives of our families, the lives of our children. You know, years ago, I looked it up, 12 years ago, I used this illustration. And several of you have come to me recently and asked me to use this illustration one more time. And it happened maybe, you know, again, 12 years ago, they did this survey amongst people that consider themselves members of the Church of Christ. Now, that obviously could be a very broad group of people, but members of the Church of Christ. And this study found that 50% of our young people are leaving the church and going into the world. We are losing 50% of our young people. And I'd look back, and if you, those of you who are my age or around my age, you look back at your own childhood, the kids that you grew up with, the people that you went to church with, how many of them are no longer faithful today? So, quite frankly, based on my experience, that 50% may be a little low. But let's use 50%. I was thinking that maybe, you know, we should start asking ourselves, which 50% are we going to keep? And which 50% are we going to lose? And I thought that maybe what we could do is right here, right now, let's decide which 50% that we love the most. Why don't we do that? Why don't we go around, all the parents, and we'll just decide what 50% do we love the most that we refuse to lose to the world, and that way we can focus all of our time, all of our energy, everything that we've got on that 50%, we won't waste our time on the other 50. Why don't we do that? You know what, we can start, it's pretty easy, we can start with the families that have, you know, four kids or more. So, you know, Clayton and Kelly, all right? So, which one of your kids, you got to pick two, which ones did you just kind of do without? Don't want to answer just yet? I know it's kind of sudden and you want to think about it. I'll get back to you, I'll come around. Kelly's shaking her head, no. Well, what about the other Johnson? How about, you know, Georgia and Jack? We've got twins. You know, so they look exactly alike. If you lose one, you just have to look at the other one twice as long and you should be okay. And, you know, and maybe you don't know, I don't know if Jack and George are here, but, you know, he will actually sometimes paint a freckle on Ralston just to mess with the rest of us so that we think that it's the same. So maybe we could just pick one of them. They're not here, so maybe we could just kind of pick one of them and we should be okay. You know, we can just kind of go around the room. You know, the Franzens clearly have way more kids than they possibly could use. So we could just kind of eliminate all of those. And we could go around the room. And in fact, if you're reluctant to do that, why don't I just do it for you? We could just concentrate on columns 1, 3, and 5. Saves us a whole lot of time. Just don't worry about everybody else. And if you don't like those columns, well, we can go to these columns and just concentrate on 2, 4, and 6. Well, what do you think? Unless, I mean, the numbers are the numbers. Those are the facts. We're losing 50% of our young people. I mean, unless you think you can beat the odds, unless you think that you can keep all of them. I mean, I agree they're all precious. But if you want to keep them all, I hope you understand what kind of commitment that you're making here. You're making a commitment to make a difference in your kids' lives. You're making a commitment that they are going to know who you are and what you stand for. You are determining to give them a legacy, an inheritance that cannot be corrupted, a memory of you, so that they know who you are and what you stood for. That's the kind of commitment that you're making. All your time, all your energy, all your love, all your prayers, all of that for your kids. Otherwise, we're just back to losing 50% of our kids. You know, that's the kind of impact, that's the kind of influence that we need to have on our kids and on everyone that we come in contact with. So how do I do that? Turn to 2 Timothy chapter 3, please. 2 Timothy chapter 3. We'll stay here for the most part for the remainder of the lesson. In 2 Timothy chapter 3, it is near the end of Paul's life, and time is short, and he writes to his spiritual child, Timothy. And Paul tells Timothy how he wants to be remembered. He's saying, Timothy, remember me for this. And he gives us seven characteristics that he's using himself as an example. Seven things that he reminds Timothy of, so that Timothy can then imitate those things. Timothy now has a memory, now has a legacy, now has an inheritance that he can hang on to. And he will be secure, because Paul's worried about his security, just like we're worried about our kids' security. So look at 2 Timothy chapter 3, beginning in verse 10. You, however, have followed my teaching, my conduct, my aim in life, my faith, my patience, my love, my steadfastness, my persecutions and sufferings that happened to me in Antioch, in Iconium, and Lystra, which persecutions I endured, yet from them all the Lord rescued me. Indeed, all who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted, while evil people and imposters will go from bad to worse, deceiving and being deceived. But as for you, continue in what you have learned and have firmly believed, knowing from whom you have learned it. Paul says that you have carefully followed, you have fully known who I am and what I have stood for. Paul was concerned what he was going to leave behind. And we need to be that have that same level of concern what we are going to leave behind. And the first thing that he says is, please remember me for my teaching. Please remember me for my doctrine. He's saying, I want to be remembered for believing the right things, for having a grasp on what is really true. You see, and that's foundational. You can't live correctly until you believe correctly. You know, and so many people, it's labeled a postmodernism, says that there really isn't any kind of system or truth. There is no absolute right or wrong. It's just kind of whatever works for you. That's all you have to be concerned about. And that kind of teaching, we call it postmodern, but really it's old. Very old. As old as the time of Paul. This is just a casual look. We're not going to go through every one of these passages. 12 times in 10 chapters to one person, to Timothy, Paul talks about doctrine. He talks about sound doctrine. He talks about good doctrine. He talks about the doctrine. Paul's saying there is truth and error. There is absolute truth. There is a system of right and wrong. So please don't say that situation ethics will apply to me. Please don't say that there is no important doctrine that everyone needs to adhere to. Paul is saying, I want to be remembered as someone who guarded very carefully the true doctrine of the gospel. That kind of belief should govern every aspect of my life. And that is a life of consistency. So in this world today full of liberalism and postmodernism, we need to hold to the infallibility of the Holy Scriptures and live in such a way that there is no doubt what I've patterned my life after and conform to what the Bible has told me. Not my own selfish desires, not what the world deems as appropriate or maybe even normal, but what the Lord has said. That is the pattern for my life. So Paul is saying it's not just my teaching, but also what's also important here is he's saying to Timothy, you need to also remember me in my conduct. You see, it wasn't just the things that Paul said that were important. It's what Paul did that was also important. It's his conduct. It is his behavior, the way that he lived. You know that how I have lived my life consistently in all circumstances. Be careful to follow after my conduct. Paul practiced what he preached. You know, we learn better when we watch things, don't we? That's why I think these home cooking shows are so popular today, because you can watch them, you can tune in, and you could figure out how to boil water. Because they're showing you how to do that. And we all learn that way. And children learn that from their parents, don't they? They watch their parents. They see the lifestyle. They know that lifestyle is biblical and wholesome and holy. And that is the lifestyle we need to behave, to follow after, to imitate. That is the conduct that we should follow after. Let me ask you two questions. What one behavior of yours, do you want your kids to emulate? Just one. And the second question is, what one behavior are you ashamed of that you do not want your children to emulate? How we answer that's pretty important, because again, we're going to influence people one way or the other. The other thing Paul says that he wants Timothy to remember is my aim in life, my purpose in life. What am I aiming at? What am I shooting for? Why am I here? You see, purpose carries with it, it needs two things. It needs a decision and it needs a determination. First, we have to make a choice. We have to decide where we're going and what is our purpose. And then we have to follow that up and back it up with will, with power, and with determination. You see, we are happiest when we are fulfilling the purpose for which we were designed. You know, I've told you, I think, in the past about my grandmother's house or even my mother's house being a house of doodads. Now, you may not be familiar with the term doodad, but a doodad is where you take something that is useful and you modify it, decorate it, you change it in some way so that it is no longer useful for the purpose. Like a fly swatter, for example. You take a fly swatter and then you can cross-stitch in there the American flag. Now, the fly swatter is useful. The purpose of a fly swatter is to swat flies. And the purpose of the American flag is to salute and to be honored. But now, it's not good for either one of those things. It just sits on the shelf and does absolutely nothing. A doorknob. A doorknob is meant to help you enter or exit a room, is it not? Well, my grandmother would knit these doorknob covers and all the doorknob is just spun in your hand. You couldn't open a door. There's nothing you could do. You were trapped in the room. Maybe that was the purpose of that. I don't know. So you had to stay and visit longer. There was nothing you could do. You couldn't get out. And all kinds of doodads were in her house. You had the Sears Roebuck catalog, if any of you remember that. They were folded up in such a way so that they were now door stops. Or soap that is decorated with sequins and pins so you can't wash with it anymore. Towels and washcloths are now folded up that they look like pets. And you have these sofas and chairs that are covered up with so many pillows, so many lacy things that there's no place to sit. So you can't get out of the room and you can't sit down either. And don't get me started about the toilet seat that's decorated that won't stay up, because that's just totally uncalled for. We have a purpose. We were designed for a purpose. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 5 says, "You yourselves, like living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God." That is our purpose. And that's what we need to be about, offering spiritual sacrifices that are acceptable to God. And Jesus said in Mark chapter 12 and verse 30, "And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength." We are designed to glorify God in everything that we do. And we need to be about fulfilling that purpose. Paul also said, "I wanted you to remember me for my faith, and be careful to follow after it." I think in this context, what Paul is talking about is his trust in God, no matter what his circumstances are. Do you ever doubt? Do you ever doubt God's promises? Worry with and have all kinds of anxiety, and that you show that to others? You know, through Paul, we have some of the greatest promises in the Bible. "All things work together for good to those that love God. My God is able to meet all your needs according to His glory in Christ Jesus. You know that your work in the Lord is not in vain. And God is able to do exceedingly, abundantly, more than all we could ever ask or think. There is laid up for us a crown of righteousness. Oh, wretched man that I am, who can save me from this body of death? thanks be to God through Jesus Christ. These are wonderful promises and ought to give us an incredible amount of trust in God, because He always fulfills His promises. You need to visualize your life like a scale. On one hand, you've got all your painful circumstances that you've had to endure, that you are enduring. And on the other side of that scale, you have the promises of God. And the promises of God always outweigh the circumstances in your life. Trust God. Be remembered for your faith. Do we have that kind of faith that other people can imitate? What our children can see in us? The kind of faith that trusts in God and believes in the promises that He's given to us. Then you have this idea of patience, Paul says, that he wants to be remembered for. Or in your translation might say, long-suffering. Throughout his life and career, Paul had to put up with two things. One was imperfect circumstances, and the other is imperfect people. Long-suffering is the ability to put up with imperfect circumstances without losing your temper, and to be able to put up with imperfect people without irritation. Are you long-suffering? I mean, do you just lose your patience? Do you get frustrated? That's not being long-suffering. You need to demonstrate that long-suffering attitude, that patient attitude, so that your children and everyone around you can imitate that wonderful characteristic. And then he wants to be remembered for his love. If you turn back to 1 Timothy chapter 1, 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5, 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5, the aim of our charge is love that issues from a pure heart and a good conscience and a sincere faith. It's the kind of love that always does what's right in its purest and most noble sense. It rises above just doing those things that we're obligated to do, but gives mercy and grace to every worthy object. Love is something that we need to show every single day. Please note that this kind of love not only does what is right, but what it wants to do what is good, truly good, for the people that we're in contact with. That means sometimes that you have to step on some toes. That means maybe you have to admonish. That means that you have to discipline. That is showing love. That is genuine love. And that needs to govern our lives. And that's what we want to be remembered for. And also you have this steadfastness or perseverance. This refusal to give up. No matter what happens, you just refuse to stop. Have you ever felt like stopping? Have you ever said, I just don't care anymore? Every Christian that has ever made a difference in this world had this characteristic of perseverance. It is a critical quality. It is the ability to abide under the wrongs that are suffered or evils without complaining, without murmuring. It is the ability to turn the other cheek. We need to be like Paul and just keep on going and not give up. And finally, he says, remember me for my persecutions and my sufferings. Now, you know, obviously the question becomes, how could anybody dislike somebody that's got these other seven characteristics? My teaching, doctrine, my behavior, my purpose, my faith, long-suffering, love, and perseverance. These are the qualities that make people great, make people admired. And yet, Paul is saying that he had to suffer through persecutions and through sufferings. And the people that would do this, if you go back to 2 Timothy chapter 3 and pick up in the very first part of that same chapter that we've been studying, beginning in verse 1 through verse 5, but understand this, that in the last days there will come times of difficulty. For people will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeasable, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not loving good, treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having the appearance of godliness but denying its power. Avoid all such people. You know, there are two groups in this world. Paul is telling Timothy. One group is worldly. One is esteemed by the world. One is admired by the world. They are characterized by the world. They use the world as their standard. We can follow that kind of an example. You can be that kind of an example. The other kind of example is the otherworldly. Paul is telling Timothy, don't follow the world. Don't follow people like this. Stand out. Stand up. And follow my example. And those are the kinds of things that matter. Those are the kinds of things, when we adopt these seven characteristics, these are the kinds of things that change the way you will be remembered, that will change the inheritance that you pass on to your children and to all those that know you and all those that love you. You know, there were two men in the 1800s. They were walking up a hill together. In front of them was a lamp lighter. And that, basically back then, all the street lamps were lit by gas. And they had to be manually lit every single night so that people could find their way home. And these two men kept walking, and the old man carrying his ladder would stop at every lamp on the street and light that light. And pretty soon he got to the top of the hill and he disappeared on the other side. And pondering what they were looking at for a moment, one friend turned to his companion and said, "I hope my life will be just like that. I should like to think that when I've gone over the brow of the hill, that I shall leave lights shining behind me." That's the kind of life that we want to live. The kind of life that we want to leave behind. James asked, in James chapter 4, he asked, what is your life? You know, he says it's a vapor. It's kind of here, and then all of a sudden it's gone. It's not around anymore. Our time to make an impact, our time to influence is limited. We don't have a lot of time to change how we will be remembered. So it's imperative that we start now. But Paul also told the Corinthians that there's really only one opinion that really counts. In 1 Corinthians chapter 4, he says, at the end of all things, what really matters is what God thinks of me. That's the important opinion that we need to be striving for. If we live this way, then God will know who you are. God will know your name because you belong to Him. And the way that you belong to Him is that you have decided to follow after Him. And you've made the determination to be one of His children. And the way you become one of His children is to believe on Him, to do away with your former life and repent of all of that, to confess His name, and then to be baptized for the remission of your sins. Then God's judgment of you will be come in, because you belong to me. And you have lived your life so that I remember who you are, and people speak well of you. But you got to start now. That isn't something you could put off and say, I'm going to start that whole process next week. Because life is short. Jehoram found that out. We don't have the kind of time that we think we do. And we need to start now changing our memories. Changing how people will think about us. Changing our position and our relationship with God. If you need to get back there, if there's anything we can do, if you want to start that relationship, if you want to restart that relationship, then we want to help you do that. We want to encourage you to be baptized in His name and dedicate your life into His service and to living the kind of life that you should live. If there's anything at all that we can do to help you, we ask that you come forward while we stand and sing for your encouragement.
I bring my sins to Thee, Jesus.